know, our discussion about the state of the world and what one can do about that. This session is on a sustainable society, sustainable agriculture. And my name's Doug Dahlstead, to all of you out there in Radio Land. And we got the thumbs up from the control technician. We're on our way. We'll come back to what we were just talking about the different varieties of sustainability in agriculture and what they're called and how they work, because that's a fundamental platform for a sustainable society. As far as historians know, there has not been a society existent on the planet here that has survived the decay of their topsoil. And the only ones that that don't fit that category are the ones that don't use topsoil. And that includes the Pacific Northwest Native American culture, fishing, hunting culture. Their agricultural enterprises were virtually non-existent. They did a little bit of gathering of camas, potato-like starch, and the wild berries. But all the other major societies that have come and gone, their demise has been either hastened or caused by a reduction in their topsoil. And there are some farmers in the group here, which is good to know. I don't come from a large farming background. I come from a real small apple orchard kind of background on Vashon Island. But from what I understand, topsoil takes anywhere from 1 inch of topsoil takes anywhere from 200 to 1,000 years to form. And the whole principle of sustainable agriculture is that you live off the income of the land, not off the capital of the land. And what that means is that if you're living off capital, you're mining the soil. You're forcing the soil to do more than it would normally do. Yeah?
If you ever take a trip through Glacier Bay by boat, you have it take you up to the face of the glacier, at which point there's no visible growing thing, and as you go down back, you turn back to Glacier Bay Lodge, you are heading to areas that have been longer and longer free of ice. And you begin to see lichen, you begin to see primitive grasses, you begin to see fireweed. You get back, and gradually things grow. And you get back to Glacier Bay, and there are 40, 50 foot high spruce trees, and there's organic soil several inches deep. And when Captain Cook visited that area, the location where the lodge is was under over 100 foot of ice. So one has to believe that under certain circumstances, land does regenerate itself faster than we are told.
Than the 200 to 1,000 years of topsoil?
Yeah. In 200 years, it's come from bare mineral soil to spruce trees 40 or 50 foot high.
Well, I don't know how much soil in the... And the kind of topsoil that has the developed layer of humus that that's required for the kind of plant and agriculture that we need.
I don't know, but there's a wide variety of other things growing on this spruce.
What I wanted to do today was, since we had a look at the great macro problems of the world, I wanted to fill you in on what the global plan of action would be, and then we'll focus in on one of those, which is the sustainability of agriculture. If we're going to get a handle on this, on these worldwide macro problems, and have a society, a world, that's going to support human beings in any measure of comfort, during the 1990s, from the best estimates of those who study these sorts of things, the 1990s is the decade that we need to turn it around. I mentioned that for the first time last year, world grain reserves were as low as they've ever been since 1973. They're below 60 million tons. And that came on the heels of the drought in the Midwest and a failure of the monsoon in India, which caused a severe reduction in grain production. Contrast that to the time between about 1950 and 70, when world grain production per capita went up 2.5 times. tremendous strides, mostly based on what we knew as the green, or the Green Revolution, and the incredible amount of fertilizers that were applied to land. We didn't find so much more land, we just farmed the land that we had more intensively. Had to produce much more. And I think you were telling me that you're in your Father's Day, and you're getting 20 bushels to the acre, and you're getting 40, 50. And that's the kind of change that you see reflected when you use the capital of the planet, which is fossil fuels, organic, or fertilizers, which came originally, like I said the other day, from guano, from bird droppings. So a global action plan, the first thing that we need to do is change our energy policy. And what that means is we've got to kick the habit of using fossil fuels. That's the bottom line. There are the three suggestions. One is to increase efficiency of those things that we already have. Another one is to diversify, to find alternatives and use them. And a third one is to expand the use of nuclear power. And the folks at World Watch, the State of the World, eliminated the third choice because their analysis was that it, being based on an economy of scale, large plants, capital intensive, were further removed from accessibility for most of the people in the world. The problems, the technical problems, have not been solved. At least they haven't been solved in the public's eye. You know, the idea of Chernobyl, that you had what amounted to really a partial meltdown of the core and contaminated a large area of land, changed people's perception toward nuclear power. And if you don't have the support of the people to do something like that, you can't do it. Now, that's completely separate from technical issues. If you don't have the will of the people to do it, it's very, very difficult to push it through. And it seems to be a worldwide perception among people now that nuclear power is something that's too risky to try, that the problems, especially in the storage and management of the waste, is not an acceptable risk. So if we eliminate that as an option, now the good thing about nuclear power is that you remove the dependence on fossil fuels. That's a tremendous benefit. But the analysis done at World Watch is that you can do this, you can accomplish the same thing by having more efficient use of energy and by having alternatives. Just for a few examples, between 1973, the great banner year when the Arab countries said, hey, we have the rest of the world just where we want them with our oil, and let's form our cartel and jack the prices up, which is what they did. We initiated a large program in this country on energy efficiency domestically, residentially, and industrially. And we cut our efficiency rate was about 26% in a reduction, which is really good. That translates into 400 million tons of carbon that weren't released. Transportation-wise, we have on the planet right now about 400 million cars. Those cars release about 500 million tons of carbon annually. It's anticipated that by the year 2010, the projection is that amount is going to double. The automobile production worldwide is going up, and it's going up rapidly. People want to be like us. We have incredible freedom in our mobility. You have places like Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, all of which have adopted a very aggressive automobile making capacity, and they're not going to stop. Brazil powers a lot of their cars by ethanol. It's an alcohol fuel. Well, the solution is to increase mass transit. And I don't know how many of you are from cities, but every city that I know of, Seattle included, is grappling with this idea of what are we going to do with all these automobiles? One need only look around at the Puget Sound Basin on any given day, and the pall of smog that's created by the automobile is not acceptable, let alone traffic congestion and all the other inconveniences that come with sprawling automobile dependency. the amount of land that's taken up and freeways, the amount of resources and energy to support those highways, it clearly is not becoming an option. You have places like Berkeley, California, that filed suit against the California State Transportation Department to prevent, to block the building of more freeways in the community. And that case is now before their court system. The alternative is to have an efficient mass transit system, have people live closer to where they work, to use bicycles. Now, that seems like maybe a quaint idea in the United States, but if you look worldwide, particularly at places like China, the reliance on the bicycle is incredible. And it's not just a bicycle as we know it, bicycles with little carts attached to them, hauling small amounts of produce to market, and children, and groceries. The potential for that is tremendous. And if you're interested in keeping abreast of what's going on, this little magazine is a great one. It's put out by World Watch Institute, and the title of it is World Watch. This particular issue, which is July-August 88, is talking about the use of bicycles in the future. And they give examples. Ghana just decided as a country to promote bicycle usage in the villages. Rather than building a road system, they tried that, and it's tremendous capital to build a road and then maintain the thing once you got it built. And they said, well, let's see if we can do this some other way. And so they've instituted a program of using bicycles for their villages, getting produce relatively short distances, 10 miles from the countryside into the cities, and getting that exchange going. I have a bicycle. I ride it as much as I can to work. Of course, my work is only about a mile away, so. But therein, that underscores quite a bit. I could either use a car or I could use a bike. Another one is an idea that we touched on the other day, which is a carbon tax. I know I don't do things that I know I ought to do a lot of times because it's too convenient not to do it. However, if integrated into my calculus of personal living was a tax, all of a sudden the inconvenience gets measured against my income. And there's a phrase that we use in environmental studies and probably economics and ethics, that the idea of mutual coercion by mutual consent. We as a body of people right here could all agree that the increasing amount of carbon in the atmosphere is not to all of our best interests or the best interests of the planet. And we might say, well, we have to reduce the carbon now. We can do that voluntarily, or we can do that by taxing ourselves for the amount of carbon that we use. And then we don't have to worry about moral sliding. We don't have to worry about ethical decisions that where we decide not to use a more efficient means of transportation. We pay for it. And what do we do with that money? Well, a carbon tax, if we did a tax that was a dollar on gasoline in this country, which would raise it about, in Europe, it's $1.50, the tax structure. It looks like that would raise about $100 billion a year. And where that money would go is it would go into reforestation of the planet. It would go into promotion of alternative energy supply. And it would go into the promotion of energy efficiency worldwide. Along the lines of the automobile, I think we would all be loath to give them up entirely. It doesn't seem very realistic. How many of us got here to hold and buy automobiles, for example? However, you can increase the efficiency of cars, and you can do it dramatically. They have cars now that'll go 70 miles a gallon. Tragically, the Department of Transportation is beginning to relax the standards on automobile efficiency. And they're doing that in the wake of a few years of what is an oil surplus on the planet, which is really a misnomer. It's only a surplus on the market. The reserves are continuing to be depleted worldwide. So the idea of stabilizing the world car population at around 500 million and having each car get a minimum of 50 miles per gallon versus the 20 now, which would reduces the carbon level to about 250 million tons a year rather than going up to the 500 million tons a year. Yeah. As far as the efficiency of electrical devices, you can do, if you could have a 64% potential there to make things more efficient, which reduces the carbon by about 27%. That's a tremendous reduction in the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere. For example, lights. Lights now put out about 250 million tons a year, and they account for about 17% of all electrical usage. Fluorescent bulbs, the Philips bulb. Anybody know of that Philips bulb? It's a long life bulb. They know how to make lights now that last a long time and that are very efficient in their use of energy. The change has been, or the need is, that more people need to use them. Improve ballast structures in electrical lighting so they don't break down. You don't have as much breakdown, particularly in the commercial sector. I know Seattle did a big study where it was called Energy 1990, I think is what it was. And this was done in the 70s. And the question was, okay, we've got this projection. Energy use has been increasing this much over the past 10, 15 years. It looks like this trend percent increase. What are we going to do to meet this demand? And the choice was hydroelectric, nuclear power, or conservation. And the hydroelectric potential in Washington is not what it was. You know, we've pretty much dammed up about as much as we want to dam up, for a variety of environmental reasons. Nuclear power is what a lot of systems bought into. And how many of you from Washington, you've heard of the WHOOPS system? You know, plants that started off costing hundreds of millions. I don't know what the grand total is now, but it's in the billions. And a lot of the plants will never get off the ground. They'll never produce a watt of electricity. It was it's the most tremendous financial boondoggle on record. Bailouts, people suing each other. Anyway, Seattle bought out of that. They said, we didn't want to do that. And what they opted to go for was conservation strategy. And as part of that, they will pay me, well, not me, they'll pay my father, who owns a home, who uses electric heat. They will pay him to insulate his home, to put in thermally efficient windows. They will pay like 73% of the cost of putting in a heat pump, which is a much more efficient system than electric baseboard heat. And they'll send people in to do it. All he has to do is sign up. And a lot of people have taken advantage of that in the Seattle, King County area. And it's worked. We've done very well. Not only have we stayed out of WHOOPS, we're all kind of going, ha, ha, ha. But we've also been able to decrease our electric consumption tremendously. Yeah, Peter.
I just heard a little bit about that new light bulb, and I assume it's the one you're talking about, the Philips. Is that going to be available, or is it available, and do you have to change your fixture dramatically? The one I heard about, it's like only takes 17 watts, and it gives as much light as the standard light bulb.
All right, and it lasts a long time.
Yeah, that's much longer. I suppose GE is going to have tremendous resistance to putting that on the market right away.
Yeah, that's overall, when it comes to personal choices and personal action on addressing these environmental problems, what it really boils down to is the power of the pocketbook, where people decide to put their money. Every time they make an exchange on the economic market, they're voting. And if they amplify that with telling the retailer or the producer why they're voting the way they are, it has tremendous impact. Tremendous. It's more expensive. Let me see. I think the last one I read about was like $7.95 per bulb. So it was a lot. But the lumen, the hours were tremendous. It was like, I don't remember how long it lasted. But.
Don't we have the technology to change a lot of things that way? I mean, I believe tires could last a lot longer with what we have, almost to the life of the car, is what I heard. And they're not going to put those out.
I'm considering exchanging some now. They've got 66,000 miles on it.
Well, I mean, that's good, but it's, I mean, life of a car, you know, the amount of rubber goods there.
You mean a real life of a car or a Detroit life of a car?
A life of a car now, not back 20 years ago, Ford yeah. Chevy. That would last 20, you know, years. But you know, I think we have a lot of ideas and things that would last and improve in our system, but because of the lack of turnover in the economy.
That's where the carbon tax comes in. When, if an example of how that works is, there's a firm in Connecticut that wants to build a power plant. Well, first of all, they can't just build a power plant. They've got to build a cogeneration plant. And cogeneration means that you use the waste heat from the electrical power generation to heat homes. That's common. You can do that from factories, you can do that from power plants, industry all over the place. And as part of a trade-off, they're doing a reforestation project down in Costa Rica. So they're going to be using, they're going to be putting carbon into the atmosphere with their power plant. And the trade-off is that they have to be as efficient about that as they can with cogeneration and create a sink of carbon through this reforestation project. Yeah.
Do you know anything about radon gas? That's a big issue that we know.
I don't know a lot about it. But I'm going to recommend to you this book. It's called Blueprint for a Green Planet. It's by John Seymour. And it's called A Practical Guide to Restoring the World's Environment. And this is chock full of individual things that you can do to modify your lifestyle a little bit with the world in mind. And it talks about radon in here, hazards in the home, ways to avoid that. The basic message that he gives is that there are a tremendous number of things that we can do. Some of them cost a little more money. Some of them have a lot to do with public pressure and applying it. I mean, he advocates very strongly that you join environmental groups, you join public interest groups that are active in pressuring governments to be more responsible. You know, that's at the one extreme. The other extreme that an individual can take is to join organizations like Earth First, which is really not an organization. It's a bunch of ecological terrorists that go out doing things like spiking trees and draining the oil out of large earth-moving equipment. And, you know, they're...
You're recommending those courses of action?
No, I'm not recommending that one. I mean, that's an individual ethical decision.
Okay,
that that their philosophy is one of do no damage to human life, cause no harm to living things, and prevent the destruction of the planet. So driving spikes into trees, I don't know about harming living things.
That could harm living things, because I've been able to
yeah.
try that.
Yeah.
That's not so they do harm.
Their point is that they're trying to underscore how serious these issues are, and I don't know, it's not my style. We talked a little bit about cogeneration, the idea of you don't do just one thing with power generation. The diversified systems, solar, hydro, wind, geothermal, all are being used, all were being promoted at the end of the Carter administration, and all, the budget, was limited by 4/5 when Reagan came into office. That's got to change. There's got to be more emphasis and research and development of those alternative systems. It's got to happen. Instead of building, like the World Bank used to do, you build a big coal generating plant of electricity for third world countries. Don't do that. The point is that you can have solar panels. You can have a lot of solar generation in a lot of those villages and completely eliminate the need for the big fossil fuel burning plants. The technology's there. The price of photovoltaics has dropped 90% since they were introduced. And with more development and more production and more market, the price is only going to go one direction, and it's down. Windmills. Any of you from California? You've got some gigantic windmills, wind farms down there.
Palm Springs. It builds up down that way.
Boeing just did a project. A friend of mine's an engineer in Hawaii, where they set up a large windmill system in Hawaii. Throughout the middle latitudes, where you have constant trade winds, all those islands out there can all exercise the wind power. It blows all the time. It makes too much sense. And yet what our attitude has been is we export the technology that we know. And what we know about are large-scale fossil fuel-burning plants. Okay, the second big area is reforestation. I mentioned a figure the other day, we need 15 billion trees for 15 years. Growing trees absorb more carbon than mature trees. The more forest that we have growing, the more carbon will be removed from the atmosphere, the better off we are. When they reach a point of maturity, then there's a sustainability in the forest. As you're planting more, you can use more. A lot of the world still uses firewood for its fuel. Forests not only provide firewood, but they're critical to localized climate and the success of agricultural enterprises, particularly in Africa. If you remove your forest cover, you increase the albedo of the planet, of the land, which means that more light is reflected back into space, which means that the surface temperatures cool, which means that dry air descends on that localized spot, which means that there isn't as much moisture as there was, and the land continues to dry out. It's a vicious cycle. Every effort that can be made to do reforestry work, reforestation work, should be done. You know, if the churches adopted that as something that they're going to do, that'd be great. There are some signs of success. The American Forestry Institute wants to, in the urban areas in the United States, plant upwards of 100 million trees by 1992. In Kenya, there's called the Green Belt Movement, which is largely organized and administered by women. And they've involved about 15,000 different villages and a half a million school kids to go out and plant a couple million trees a year. Tremendously important things. Yeah?
Aren't there cities like San Jose and Los Angeles doing a city-wide thing that also ties in the energy policy, like reduces the temperature of like a city-wide by maybe 10 degrees? There's a lot of these cool things that can shade your house.
I don't know of it specifically, but I know of that urban agriculture and urban forestry is a large and growing area. And yeah, it does. It reduces, forests keep the climate, the localized climate, cool. Yeah. What do you do about these poor third world places where their most accessible place for ready cash is in their forests? They've got a tremendous third world debt. They have people after them to pay. They've got horrendous development issues that are confronting their society, and there are these vast tracts, seemingly, of forests. Whack, go cut them down, you get some ready cash. Well, so there are some conservation organizations that have done some creative things. There's this debt for nature SWAT. If you've heard of that, the idea is that Brazil is never going to pay its debt, folks. It's way, way out of hand, to the point where Brazil more or less sent that message back to the banks that, hey, we'll just, you know, default on them. Brazil was a good bet at one time. Their economy was growing. They had a lot of things happening. They were taking this capital in. They were capitalizing their country. It looked great. And then their market for their automobiles fell off. The oil crisis hit, and a number of other factors came into play. And all of a sudden, Brazil is stuck with this gigantic debt, these massive hydroelectric plants, large emphasis on automobile industry, and nowhere to sell it. So what do you do? Well, environmental organizations have come in and said, look, we'll buy your debt, 10 cents on the dollar, a penny on the dollar, whatever it is. You have to agree to set up a sustainable forestry district in your area or a forest preserve, and we'll handle your debt with the lending institution. Lending institutions have really nothing to lose. They're not going to get the money back anyway. Furthermore, the World Bank is beginning to make loans for energy efficiency and reforestation projects. And that it runs contrary to a long history of only doing large capital type projects like hydroelectric dams. Let's take a little aside. The reason they are doing that is that for a long time, the largest problem in the planet was focused on increasing population. that's still a gigantic problem. It's one of the four in this energy or in this global plan. But the solution to that problem was that if you increase the standard of living of the people, they will have fewer children. It's called the demographic transition. And now the growing emphasis is that you can't increase the standard of living of the people until you take care of their environment, their land. So the Global Bank is beginning to shift from just economically oriented projects to ones that lend support to a sustainable agricultural base, a sustainable society. It's a slow transition, but they're beginning. They're starting to make loans now in that direction, and that's really encouraging. Third big area. Yeah, question?
I was going to say a classic example of what you were talking about, cutting down the forest and seeing the temperature rise in Phoenix has 20 meters. It's a little bit sprawl and large growth and less growth, but no longer. And the temperature has risen like 8 degrees average over the past, I don't know what, 10 years. Not a game on the summer, and it's just running off because of cement just can't absorb it.
Yeah, it said that asphalt is the final use for land. It's the land's last use. I mentioned in the reforestation, the 130 million hectares, which is about 15 billion trees per year for 15 years, add to that another 40 million in the industrialized countries. Now, in our countries, forestry isn't generally seen as a problem in the sense that we usually replant, we've got a lot of forest, especially here in the temperate areas. When you cut the forest, they regenerate of their own pretty fast, especially in the Northwest. But the potential, again, for planting about between 5 and 7 billion trees in the industrialized areas is tremendous and real important. And then it's real good to see that as a goal of the American Forestry Society. Food, well, yeah.
It's kind of hard to know what trees to plant, though, now. Like, I was selecting a couple trees recently for my yard, and I was reading the things about how trees can't travel very fast with the warming trend. And so the traditional trees that you could plant in Minnesota before, you know, maybe I should be planting palm trees or, you know.
Right.
So, how do you figure out what tree to plant? I went up and I was, you know, trying to decide what tree to buy.
I think for your area, the kind of the watchword is to plant what's local. And I would talk to the forestry association in your area and find out what's been working and what's not. We've been doing reforestation and habitat revitalization in the Northwest, and there's a tremendous emphasis on using local species. Local, not even from California, but local to the north, to the Pacific Northwest in Washington.
But my point is, if a tree's supposed to live like 100 years, and if the temperature is going to go up several degrees in that 100 years, you know, most of our local forest is going to die because it won't be the right kind of tree anymore. It won't be resistant to the heat. It was really hot in the Midwest last summer.
Plus acid rain and all the other stresses that are impacting the forest.
Plant all these forests and they all die, it won't do too much good.
Well, that's true.
Not planting them?
No, I just want to know what to plant.
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that one of World Watch's strategies for food production is to continue to rely on biotechnology to develop salt-resistant and drought-resistant plants. And maybe that'll be a direction in forestry as well. I don't know. Yeah.
In addition to the Forestry Service, each state has a cooperative extension association which does research at their state level, and that filters down to a county association, which every country has. And they have lists of trees that are recommended in certain areas, plus new introductions, because they'd like to get some diversity in it. Mm-hmm. But I think what we have to begin to understand is while trees used to live for 100 years, that in many instances is no longer possible because we put them in areas that don't sustain them for that long a period of time anymore. What we used to think of as a 100-year tree now may be only a 50-year tree.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Africa, they're recommending trees like willows that grow quickly with a lot of production and use the limbs for firewood as they're growing. The willows grow up eventually, then you cut them down for other products and plant them again. So, as I said, the growing tree absorbs more carbon than the mature forest. Although, overall, in balance, there's some question about that, of what else goes on in a forest, the other values. Yeah. Yeah, it does. There are trees that fix nitrogen, which is one of the critical elements in the soil. Leguminous trees are those that fix nitrogen. Those are the kinds that they recommend to be planted in Africa in something called agroforestry, which is mixing agriculture and forestry. One way they do that is wind cropping. They plant a row of leguminous trees, and then they have land that's in croppage. And then they plant another row of leguminous trees, and it goes on like that. And they use the trees for their firewood concerns and for selective cutting when they get to be of age. They also provide animal habitat, which is really important to get manure back on the land. You need a lot of animals running around out there. And they also provide leaves, which go back into the soil to regenerate it. So those kinds of strategies seem to be real workable. Furthermore, you can't do in Africa what we do here on the Great Plains. And a lot of our own ignorance as a Western civilization was to take a lot of our ideas into other places where they just simply don't work. And you go into Africa and you try and teach those people that, hey, you know, if you just do this and you create a flatland type culture, agriculture, it's not going to last long. And it doesn't. It hasn't. It hasn't worked well. It's created to a tremendous amount of desertification across the planet.
Well, the productive spur tree has been remarkably successful in many parts of the world where it's not indigenous.
Excuse me?
The Douglas fir tree is being remarkably successful in many parts of the world where it was not indigenous.
And spruce. They're growing a lot of spruce around. So I don't know about forestry as far as taking Pacific Northwest trees to other places. Can you give me an example of where that's happening?
Some of the Scandinavian countries, Austria, some in New Zealand. However, there's one of the California trees that's really doing better than Douglas fir, most of it out of the New Zealand area. Monterey pine, I think it is.
Yeah. In the food production area, they've got to get a handle on their soil erosion. They're going to rely on biotechnology. There are places where there isn't much more land to farm, but they can farm some land more intensively, like Brazil. Brazil holds a lot of potential. Argentina holds potential, and the Soviet Union holds potential. The world population is continuing to go up dramatically at the rate of about 90 million people a year. And the situation isn't getting any better. In fact, for at least a sixth of humanity, the progress of humanity is going down. Their lives are becoming that much more strained. The potential for calamity is real good. And if we think that starvation isn't happening now, we're wrong. It's happening. It's been happening for a long time, particularly in Africa and a lot of parts of Asia. It's just that the magnitude of the problem, the potential for it to become much, much larger, is right there. They're talking about one of the strategies that I was just mentioning, growing local crops. Instead of importing wheat as a crop to grow, you grow local ones. Things like millet, chickpeas, cassava. Plants that tend to add things back into the soil as well. And one of the things that you see up at Holden here, if you read their food philosophy, which is on the west side of the building, they talk about eating lower on the food chain. Just to give an example, 1/4-pound hamburger has the equivalent amount of grain that it would take to feed a person for 2 days. It has to do with the transfer of energy through the feeding levels on the planet. It takes this much green to feed a cow. You lose, you only transfer about 10% amount of that energy. You got to feed that cow for a long time. You take it, you slaughter it, you get a quarter pound of hamburger that I'm eating for a meal. That same amount of grain that it took to get that quarter pound feeds a person for 2 days. And we're seeing more and more people moving away from beef and into other meats. Poultry is going up, fish is going up worldwide. At the same time, you see the Japanese community with their taste is trending more toward beef and away from their traditional pork and fish, although they eat a tremendous amount of fish still.
Water also. John, to point out, how many gallons of water?
Well, I guess you use like 2,600 gallons of water to produce a ton of meat. A lot of huge aquifers on the eastern slope of Colorado is being depleted like 8 or 9 feet a year. This huge underwater lake to irrigate cornfields in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And then when that water goes, it will be gone.
Furthermore, if you want to make the connection between the fast food that you might eat, which is convenient, you know, face it, it's really convenient to whip in there and bam, there's a meal. Well, a lot of that beef is grown in Central and South America, Costa Rica. Costa Rica is not designed climatically, biologically, to have big cattle farms. It just doesn't, the land doesn't support it for very long. They have these big farms. They sell their meat to Wendy's, McDonald's, Burger King, those sorts of places. It's cheap. It's cheap for the companies. And it's real expensive in a global sense. One of the places you can vote with your pocketbook and also with your pen. You write the company and tell them that this is not a practice that is ethical in light of the world's global problems. I can imagine what a bunch of high school kids could do if they wanted to take responsibility for their planet, if they all went up to the local eatery and started asking the manager where their beef came from. I mean, nothing is going to make a manager shaking his boots more than knowing that the people who are the bread and butter of his existence are questioning his practices. Yeah?
Well, how is the other beef compared to beef in terms of culture?
It's a little bit better transfer of energy, and it doesn't take the intensity of resources to get it. In other words, there are a lot of... One of the tenets of sustainable agriculture is that you have a mixture of crops and a mixture of animals on the farm. And a lot of animals, chickens, hogs, can be fed literally with household waste, with very little input. A lot of our modern beef in the States is raised in these factory farms where these cows, I don't know if it's literally true that they don't see the light of day, but they don't see the light of the pasture land.
So is most of the chicken.
So is most of the chicken, yeah. And turkeys and pigs.
You mentioned hogs. That household waste. I was involved where they wouldn't let us take that from a school cafeteria unless it was placed in a position where they could boil it to heat it to destroy any germs that might have been in there. So that requires something if they use that. But hog feeding usually with grains as well.
Mm-hmm.
They use a lot of grain.
Well, on the old farms that I understand, they used to just feed the hogs with leftovers, essentially, it was a boil down to.
Modern hog farmer would not let any one of us into his operation because of disease.
Because of disease?
Yeah, there's a disease in the hogs. There's no way that if you were going to get in there, you would be like, you would go through a procedure literally like going into surgery.
Yeah.
And to speak of practically feeding hog operation off of garbage.
Well, mind you, when I'm talking about hogs and animals, I'm talking about very small farms that have very small amounts of animals. No, even in the States.
Yeah, they don't operate that small.
You're not going to have enough pork produced on the farms, small farms in the United States to take care of the McDonald's, let alone the rest of them.
Granted, McDonald's may be a dinosaur.
Well, they don't feed a lot of pork.
No, they don't. They don't. The other, Europeans say that, well, you know, we grow our cattle locally. Well, the feed for those cattle comes from Central and South America and other places that can ill afford to ship their grain to Europe to feed the cows, to feed wealthy Westerners. It's very difficult to get information from fast food restaurants where their beef comes from. It's very difficult. They've gone down into Costa Rica and talked to the farmers, trying to get an idea of where their beef goes. And it's real difficult to trace because they know it's a sensitive issue. So, yeah.
So the big issue is when we get rid of the little farm and go into corporate farming, that's the root of the whole problem.
Well, that's certainly an arguable point, yeah, that the modern factory farm, the agribusiness, is really contrary to the best interest of a sustainable agriculture.
I remember reading an article saying it only takes 50,000 corporate farmers to feed all of America. I mean, there's that many little farms in Minnesota itself that...
Yeah, part of what happens among the American consumer is the question, what's in my food? And what's in my food that I don't want in there? You mentioned the pork farms where they won't let people in there because of the disease.
Well, these are family farms.
Well, similar situations exist.
Pardon?
I was just saying similar situations exist in the cattle farms, and they have to, what they've done is they've adopted a strategy of feeding them low levels of antibiotics throughout their lives to keep the disease down. Well, those antibiotics just don't go away either. They go through the food system. Not only that, but they develop a situation on the planet where you have a lot of the microorganisms that are affected by those antibiotics, the ones you want to keep at bay, are developing resistant strains. Furthermore, everything that we eat, if we eat a lot of those antibiotics in our own system, we're helping to spread a global system that is promoting strains of organisms that are resistant to antibiotics. And so there are ethical and health questions there too. Let alone, again, it's a consumer issue. If consumers go to the store and they see red meat versus meat that's just been, it's been organically farmed and doesn't have the red dyes added to it, most people pick the red meat because we all know that red meat is good meat. Well, people are beginning to question that too. How much of what we eat and use in our daily life is stuff that we need? How much of it is cosmetic? And how much of it really relates to food value? And that's where and we got to get to this, the sustainable agriculture, people are beginning to make that choice with their pocketbooks. This last couple of years, according to this article, they sold out. They were just astounded with the demand in the Washington, D.C. area. They had $20 million worth of business. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the rest of American agriculture. But you got to realize that that growth came in 5 years.
What would that be as a percentage, say, a drop in the bucket?
I don't know that. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Well, the last one is population. Look, we got to do something about population. That's all there is to it. What works is that a country has to have some sort of population plan and support of educational and family planning services available to the people. Incentives work real well. For example, China, South Korea, and Singapore all offer free education, free health care if you only have one child. Now that's a good incentive, and some of them with two children. So again, you're tying a population strategy into an individual pocketbook. And China and Japan have been two countries that have done tremendous things with their population growth, although China, discouragingly, has just relaxed that. They're beginning to reconsider the one child per family strategy that they had adopted that lowered their growth rate from 2.6 down to 1.3. And they're beginning to allow people to have two people, a replacement. Okay, there are six, for sustainable agriculture, there are six basic points. One is localism. Two is soil improvement. Third one is pollution abatement. Fourth one is the quality of the produce, or the product. Fifth one is energy use. And the sixth one is employment. These are standards of the Federation of the Organic Agricultural Movement, which is a national organization. And localism. There's a tremendous amount of energy that's used in shipping products all over the world. We, in our society, we've had the great convenience of having oranges and bananas and anything else any time of the year we want. And there's a tremendous cost in that. There's a tremendous global cost in that. Soil improvement. There's like 1.7 billion tons of topsoil is leaving the United States every year. 25 billion tons worldwide. The topsoil does not regenerate that fast. Even if it regenerates faster than 200 years, it doesn't come back that fast. Now, there may be some technological wizardry that will invent microbes that create topsoil at a prodigious rate. Who knows? But what we know now is that we're forcing the soil to do things above and beyond what it would normally do. And we're doing that by providing tremendous amounts of artificial fertilizers to them. Fertilizers that are synthesized from our fossil fuels. Again, resulting in a tremendous energy drain on the planet. Pollution abatement is the same thing. Most of the nitrogen that gets dumped on a farm, the estimates are about half of it at least washes off. Where does it go? Well, it doesn't just go away, it goes into the water systems. Nitrite pollution is a tremendous problem even where I live on a little island. It's a much larger problem across the country. Quality of the produce. Again, the American consumer is beginning to say, I don't want all that garbage in my food, I just want real food. And according to, again, this article, the managers are amazed at who's buying the food, and it's not just yuppies. They've got these food chains that are now going nationally all over the place, and they're amazed at the success of them in blue-collar communities, white-collar communities. Wherever they've put them in, people have shown a tremendous interest in it. Yeah.
How much of that do you think is due to the people thinking there's a lack of carcinogens in the organic food?
Oh, I think it's tremendous. Yeah.
I couldn't hear the question.
She was saying how much of the shift in public purchasing might be related to the perception of the public that organic food has a lack of the carcinogenic additives, pesticides, herbicides, residues that are left on it. And I think it's tremendous.
Do you think that there is a difference?
Depends where you are. They've had big, in California, they had an organization that was an independent laboratory certify their food as organic, and there have been a couple of suits where they have found pesticides residues on the produce, and there's suits and countersuits about where that pesticide residue came from and whether or not the farmer was developing organically or whether they were doing low input, which is providing a limited amount, or integrated pest management where they're spraying, but they're not spraying on a schedule and they're not spraying cosmetically. They're spraying only if their pest population gets above a certain point and other methods aren't handling it. And there are farmers that are doing that. You know, the wise use of chemicals. My sister's an agronomist in Washington State. She's a pest inspector. And her background is in integrated pest management. She tells me that there are times when it's stupid not to use a pesticide, when it's financially ruinous to a farmer. I mean, you can be a martyr and say, well, you know, I'll go down with my fields. Her opinion is that you need to diversify your approach to pest control in the ways that you plant, timing, integrating natural predators, using pheromones to attract predators, get rid of them in other ways, and very specific application of pesticides when it's called for and in proper amounts. Yeah.
In New York, in the last 10 years, you have greatly increased what pest wasps they can sweep in different crops, and they develop computer programs so that they know where the economic level is such that if you've got less than a certain amount of insect, it's not feasible to use pesticides, but if you have more than, whereas the recommendations 10 years ago were to spray every so many days,
right,
it'll cover. Now they're very specific on you only spray when you're, when it's economically, you're right out of cutting.
Right, yeah. And not trying to eliminate all the pest,
no,
which is another change in thinking.
This is a little off the subject, but would you say something about the energy efficiency of milk? I mean, it takes a cow to support a milk, and you're saying beef is too high on the food chain maybe for us to consider to use constantly, but you know, it takes a cow to get milk, so is that where that falls?
In the global level, food production, having local animals that produce milk is real important. Real important.
How about Americans?
You know, I really don't know. I don't know the answer to that. What I know is that the public is growing increasingly concerned about what's in the milk that comes from the cows. There's a large concern a few years ago about dioxin. In the Midwest, you had some issue about some radiation that was being passed on through the milk of cows. I don't know if you remember that, but there was made headlines out where I live.
What it takes to support a dairy farm. Is that unreasonable?
Well, I know in Washington that there are a lot of dairy farms up in the Skagit Valley, and the biggest problem with the dairy farms is the nitrates that get washed off the farm into the water. I don't know about the energy with that. Yeah.
There's a chart in a book called Diet for a Small Planet that lists beef is 16 to 1, and pork is like 6 to 8 to 1, turkey and chicken is like 4 to 1.
How about dairy?
Dairy is, I think, it's like 2 or 3. I mean, it's in the chart.
Okay. The basic tenet of sustainable agriculture or sustainable society in any respect is that you live off the income of the land, not off the capital. Has to do with, you were mentioning water mining down in, was it Phoenix? Or in Nevada, places like that where the water table is going down, 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 down. You're mining a reserve that's not replenishing as fast as you're using it. If you use the excess, that's the definition of the sustainability. Same thing with the soil. It's possible, we have known for centuries how to keep soil healthy. You have to recycle your nutrients back into the soil. You have to have a high level of organic matter. It's not going to produce as much. But the trade-off is that what farmers have found, it takes about 4 or 5 years to make a transition from a chemical base to an organic base. And initially, the two things. One is that you don't get as much off the land. You don't get the 50 bushels that you'd be getting. But the costs of doing it go down proportionally as well. So whereas you're not spending as much money on the pesticides and on the fuel for the mechanization of the farm that it takes, all the applications that you're doing, there's a commensurate decrease in the cost of doing the business of farming. Yes?
You apply that to the variable fixed rates in the agricultural operation. Have you also factored in, or have they factored in, fixed rates?
Such as?
Well, the cost of capital, you've got the cost of the land, the taxes on it, things like that. Is that factored into that too? Are you looking at variable inputs?
I have to go back and read the statistics.
I agree with your hypotheses and your arguments here. Now, you have to say, actually take individual farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And say, do you want to go to this type of a production? Or, do you want to go to this type of production? They're going to sit there and wave this around. What you addressed is, I am receiving as variable inputs, not
right,
inclusive. And it's a question, I don't know.
Well, in Illinois, how huge the farms are. There's a lot of farmers who are going this route. And for 4 or 5 miles, or years, it's really bad. But
total gross. That's what you're speaking of. Yeah, net, I guess. Yeah, because I think it's
net.
Net is more.
Yeah. That's, when I understand that as net, it's more too.
The thing is, does the guy have to, if the guy owns the land already, you can do it. I mean, and I was based on what you're saying, though, and I hear that. If you don't own the land, if you have to move it to another generation, there is a transfer tax that goes on. At least I'm speaking with this society now here. And is it a sustainable operation across a period of time? That's my question.
You have to go out and buy $1,000 an acre land. You can do one thing. You can get the land for $200 an acre.
And if it's $3,000 an acre, it's another thing.
Well, part of that is reflected in our tax structure that looks at land as a commodity at its highest and best use. In Washington, farmers are, they're taxing them out of existence because there are factories, commercial areas that are going in next door, which makes the value of their land for that use tremendously high. If you keep the land at in farming, if you had, for example, the kinds of zones that said this is only farming land and that's all you can use it for, then that eliminates that kind of economic pressure.
Chuck, you know, isn't Minnesota right now, at least, isn't that problem pretty much alleviated? Highest and best use rate?
Well, in the metropolitan cities area, there was great pressure to turn farmland into urban uses.
About a decade ago.
And the legislature passed a law allowing the metropolitan counties, if they chose, to adopt approaches that would, in effect, give an economic incentive to the farmer to continue the land in farming. It wasn't obligatory, but there was an incentive to them. They got an assured tax rate for always 8 years ahead, 8 years from today into the future. As long as they didn't sell the land for urban development purposes, they were assured that it would be taxed at a lower rate for agricultural purposes. And that seems to be working. Reasonably well,
and it puts it off 8 years.
But it's always 8 years in the future. If you decide today that you want to sell, you have to wait 8 years from now to get the
state of Washington, King County
has taken another
Auburn Valley. Yeah. A few acres have been put in, but they're putting out more asphalt than they're putting in.
Yeah.
But doesn't King County have an approach in which the public is buying with tax dollars?
Well, that was
right.
We've been talking about drops of water in a bucket.
Right.
A small drop in a big bucket.
Yeah.
You mean not a lot of farmers doing it, or actually?
There wasn't a lot of money to do it with.
Oh.
As well.
Bean Belt law in Washington, though, in our county, Washington County, you can put your farm land in the Bean Belt. Your tax is very low, and you can stay that way 13 years. Then, if you want to do it, you can sell for what you want.
Yeah, that only makes sense. It only makes sense to keep farmland in production as farmland.
Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, what they take for industrial is usually your low land, flat land, the highest and best agricultural land you've got in there.
It's the easiest to develop.
Yeah.
They take it for highways too, for the same reason.
But yeah, I think you have to weigh this. You know, the variable costs are tremendous. The cost of fertilizers, and again, barring any technological breakthrough of probably in biotechnology, it's just going to continue to escalate. And the cost of pesticides, fungicides, herbicides, all of which characterize most modern farms based on fossil fuels, is just going to go up and up and up. The big transition, and again, it's a social one, in organic farming is to use more labor. It's more labor intensive.